The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 23rd, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a jail scene. A smiling Vladimir Putin is holding a cell door open as a basketball star Brittany Griner walks out. But still in the jail, holding onto the bars and looking concerned, is the other American prisoner held in Russia, Paul Whelan, one of the others. The headline is, Freedom for One. Should U.S. have traded for Griner even though Whelan remains behind bars? That's our controversy of the week, but we will start with the first main story. Hospitals deluged as COVID fuels triple-demic. What happened? Health officials this week warned of a likely COVID surge during the holidays amid a triple-demic of three viruses, COVID, influenza, and respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. Daily COVID case counts have more than doubled over the past 2 weeks, according to the CDC, while deaths are up 65% and hospitalizations 22%. At the same time, the U.S. is suffering the worst flu outbreak in over a decade, with more than 13 million cases and 7,300 deaths. And case counts are continuing to climb. The result for some hospitals is a crush of patients not seen since last winter's Omicron surge. Mississippi is down to 65 ICU beds and sending overflow to neighboring states. In Southern California, hospitals have put beds in parking lots and auditoriums. In Oregon, a bed shortage has become extremely serious, and State Health Officer Dean Seidlinger, hospitals are overwhelmed. Health officials urged Americans to get flu shots and bivalent COVID boosters, which studies show significantly reduce the risk of serious illness. Only about 13.5% of those eligible have gotten the new booster. Don't wait. If you wait, you put yourself at risk, said White House Infectious Disease Advisor Anthony Fauci. Health officers in New York City, Los Angeles, and Seattle recommended masking in indoor public spaces. Officials in Los Angeles County, where cases have nearly tripled in a month, warned a mask mandate may be forthcoming if cases continue to rise. What the editorial said. First, the good news, said the Baltimore Sun. We're not returning to the bad old days of 2020 or last winter's brutal Omicron surge. The bad news is we all must reinstate some pandemic best practices on our own to keep ourselves and loved ones safe this winter. That means wearing a quality mask in public spaces and getting a flu vaccine and a COVID booster, or the original jabs if you're among the holdouts. As cases climb, said the Washington Post, the federal government and community leaders must redouble efforts to improve booster uptake, especially among the elderly. COVID hospitalizations among those 70 and older have jumped 28% since Thanksgiving, and 9 out of 10 COVID deaths are currently among those 65 and older. But only 32.6% of Americans over 65 have gotten the highly effective bivalent booster. This represents a public health failure. What the columnist said. Here we go again, said Yassim Tayag in The Atlantic. Another COVID wave is gathering force. Experts agree it will almost certainly not cause as much serious illness and death as last winter's Omicron surge, but beyond that, they aren't sure what will happen next. On the plus side, the now dominant strains, BQ1 and BQ1.1, are Omicron offshoots that seem not to produce life-threatening illness in most healthy people. And widespread vaccination and prior infection mean we have a stronger wall of immunity. But immunity fades with time, and low booster uptake and the near total abandonment of COVID precautions create ideal conditions for a significant surge as people travel and gather for the holidays. We need to talk about face masks again, said Finit Nirupal and Tara Parker Pope in the Washington Post. Health experts are redoubling their call to wear high-grade medical masks in stores, on buses and trains, and on planes and in airports. They're remarkably effective in reducing your risk of getting COVID, the flu, and RSV, all of which are airborne viruses. A California study found those who consistently wore cloth masks were 56% less likely to test positive than the maskless. The protection grew to 66% for surgical masks and 83% for N95 and KN95 masks. The problem is that mitigation measures have largely been abandoned, said physician Eric Topol in the Los Angeles Times. More than 400 Americans are dying of COVID daily, but few of us are masking, and lots of people are gathering indoors without testing or adequate ventilation. Booster uptake is low, despite CDC data showing an 80% reduction in hospitalizations for people with two booster shots compared with the unvaccinated. The pervasive attitude is that the pandemic is over, but wishful thinking won't make it true. The new COVID wave is talking to us. Let's listen and take action. And the controversy of the week, Brittany Griner, the steep price of freedom. What matters is that she's home, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Brittany Griner, 32, the WNBA star arrested in Moscow in February for possession of cannabis oil, was freed from a Russian penal colony last week after President Biden brought her back in exchange for Victor Bout, 55, a notorious Russian arms dealer. The trade might look unequal, but Biden was absolutely right to make it. Nicknamed the Merchant of Death, Bout sold weapons to brutal African warlords, the Taliban, and Islamic terrorists. Bout had served 11 years of a 25-year sentence in an Illinois federal prison. Some on the right are professing outrage that Biden traded for Griner without also freeing Paul Whelan, an ex-Marine and security expert jailed in Russia since 2018 on trumped-up espionage charges. The truth is that U.S. negotiators did everything they could to bring Whelan home, but Russia demanded the return of Vadim Krasikov, a Russian spy and assassin serving life in Germany. Since the government would never agree to release Krasikov, the only available deal was Griner for Bout. Turning it down would have meant letting an American suffer indefinitely in unspeakable conditions. Is that what Republicans would have preferred? This deal is not only a moral abomination, said Jim Garrity in National Review. It's a geopolitical blunder. The sheer lopsidedness of the trade, a U.S. sports celebrity for an international war criminal, has handed Vladimir Putin a badly needed public relations triumph in Russia. It's hard to overstate the human impact of Bout's illegal arms sale, which enabled barbarous men to slaughter civilians, kidnap and enslave children, and accumulate power. But you have to wonder about the politics behind this trade, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. Did Griner, a self-described social justice activist, who said during the George Floyd protest in 2020 that the WNBA should not play the national anthem, get preferential treatment from a Democratic administration because Whelan is a straight white man and she is a black lesbian? It's good that Griner is home, said Max Boot in the Washington Post, but her release should prompt a serious reconsideration of our hostage trading policies. Since Ronald Reagan sent arms to Iran for the release of kidnapped diplomats, terrorists and rogue nations around the world have been seizing Americans to see what they can extract from Washington. Every new trade only creates inducements to seize more Americans in the future. It is indeed a core responsibility of the U.S. government to protect our citizens worldwide, said John Bolton in the Washington Examiner. To that end, we need to shut down hostage-taking as a profitable enterprise. If we had to surrender a murderous arms dealer for a basketball player caught with cannabis, what will be the price for other American hostages? Obviously, much higher than a week ago. Vladimir Putin no doubt thinks he won this trade, said Julia Ioffe in Puck News. The Russian dictator and his minions refused to release Whelan along with Griner because they knew it would cause racial and partisan division in the U.S., but Biden had to take what he could get and achieved a major political victory by bringing Griner home just before Christmas. Her joyous reunion with her wife and friends is uplifting proof that America seeks to protect its citizens, whoever and wherever they are. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for active seniors, with a new study suggesting that the active ingredient in Viagra could lower users' risk of Alzheimer's disease by up to 70%. Researchers speculated that Viagra might have neuroprotective effects in addition to the better-known one. It was a good week for shaming after Kanye West, a.k.a. Ye, was named the 2022 Anti-Semite of the Year by StopAntisemitism.com for his descent into Hitler praise and rancid Jew hatred. Ye lost an estimated $1 billion in endorsement and licensing deals this year. It was a good week for women after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Treasurer Lynn Malerba saw their signatures reproduced on new U.S. currency, the first not to have a man's signature. Money, said Yellen, can tell us who we are, what we value, and what is possible. It was a bad week for Elon Musk, the Twitter CEO, who, according to Forbes, is no longer the planet's richest person. Musk has reportedly failed to pay rent on Twitter's San Francisco offices and is auctioning off office furniture and souvenirs, including a four-foot-tall Twitter bird. It's a bad week for camouflage after a Polish man dressed as a Christmas tree slashed the tires of 21 cars at a warehouse parking lot. This was more of a guerrilla action than a well-prepared operation, said warehouse owner Mateusz Watral. Branches were scattered everywhere. Finally, it was a bad week for Roger Stone after the Trump advisor said on a conservative radio show that a demonic portal, visible to the naked eye and swirling like a cauldron, has opened in the sky above the White House. The media doesn't cover a lot of things that are true, Stone added. The title of this week's briefing is Back to the Moon and Beyond. The Artemis Orion spacecraft completed a trip around the moon this week. What does NASA have planned next? Why return to the moon? NASA wants to establish a manned base there as a stepping stone to Mars. The Apollo program that put the first humans on the moon in 1969 was mostly about winning the space race with the Soviet Union. The new moon program, called Artemis, will replicate Apollo in landing astronauts on the lunar surface and bringing them safely back home. But then the program continues, with the goal of establishing a continual human presence on the moon. NASA plans to build a space station that orbits the moon and a base camp on its surface, all fueled by small nuclear reactors. Part of the goal is to mine the moon's minerals, but the bigger aim is to set it up as a way station to test whether humans can safely live in space for the months it would take to send them to Mars. The real goal is Mars, said astronaut Steven Swanson. We will use the moon as a test bed. The first step in that goal, Artemis 1, was a resounding success. What did Artemis 1 do? The new Space Launch System, SLS, rocket blasted the Orion capsule into space on November 16. During its 42-day journey, Orion carried three mannequins, high-tech models of humans loaded with sensors, into a lunar orbit, fired its thrusters to escape lunar gravity, and returned safely to Earth with a splashdown in the Pacific. One mannequin, Munakin Campos, measured how bumpy the ride would be, while two others, Zohar and Helga, were set up to test how women's bodies would react to the radiation in space. Many other tests were also conducted. What comes next? Artemis 2, planned for 2024, will repeat the first mission, but with human beings on board. One of the crew will be a Canadian, as Artemis is a multinational effort. The crew capsule will loop a wide orbit around the moon, reaching 4,600 miles beyond the far side, the farthest out in space that humans have ever been. Artemis 3, ambitiously scheduled for 2025, will send four astronauts to the moon and land two of them, including the first woman and the first person of color, on the surface for the first time since 1972. While the Apollo astronauts landed near the moon's equator, Artemis astronauts will explore its south pole, which features steep mountains as well as deep crevices that hold water ice. After that, the plan is for an SLS rocket to go to the moon about once a year, allowing astronauts to assemble an orbital space station and then, by the early 2030s, a surface habitat in which astronauts can live for a week at a time. How much does this cost? At least $93 billion through 2025, which is far more than planned. The SLS rocket is NASA's most powerful ever, taller than the Statue of Liberty, and capable of carrying 27 tons of cargo. But it took more than a decade to make and cost more than $20 billion to develop, more than twice its budget. Aerospace expert Wendy Whitman Cobb told Vox that Congress tolerated the budget overruns because Artemis has kept the money and jobs flowing to key congressional districts. Each SLS can only be used once, making them inefficient and costly. By contrast, the Super Heavy launch vehicle Starship, which Elon Musk's SpaceX is building for NASA to use as the lunar landing vehicle, is reusable. What is the role of SpaceX? SpaceX beat out Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin company to provide the lunar lander for Artemis 3 under a contract worth nearly $3 billion. The Starship human landing system will ferry the astronauts from their Orion capsule in orbit around the moon down to the surface. SpaceX envisions a craft like the old space shuttle that will eventually travel back and forth from either Orion capsules or the Gateway Lunar Space Station to the surface. But Starship hasn't been tested yet, and SpaceX hasn't said why it's been delayed. If SpaceX can't deliver on time, Artemis 3 will be postponed. Who else is going to the moon? America's geopolitical rivals. Last year, China struck a deal with Russia to cooperate in building their own joint lunar base. China first landed a rover on the moon in 2013. It plans three more unmanned missions over the next decade, with a goal of landing Taikonauts on the surface in 2030. There's already bad blood between the U.S. and China, as NASA Administrator Bill Nelson has accused China of stealing U.S. technology and both countries are planning bases on the South Pole. Meanwhile, Blue Origin and SpaceX will send their own missions, separate from NASA's. It would be tragic for Neil Armstrong's bootprints to be erased, either inadvertently or maliciously, because of all these activities on the moon. Space law expert Michelle Hanlon told Vox, "It's going to get very crowded very soon." Competition over the moon. NASA is partnering with the space agencies of Canada, the EU, and Japan to build the Lunar Space Station, and the U.S. has taken the lead on establishing a legal framework for international lunar cooperation. NASA and the U.S. State Department together wrote the Artemis Accords, whose signatories agree to respect safety zones around other nations, lunar activities, and recognize the right to extraction and utilization of ores. In the past 2 years, 21 countries have signed that pact, but crucially, China and Russia have not and refuse to be bound by its rules. They condemned the pact as colonialist, saying it paves the way for the U.S. to loot the moon before other countries can get there. The biggest risk is you have two opposite sets of rules, Australian defense expert Malcolm Davis told Bloomberg. You could have a Chinese company on the moon in the 2030s, claiming territory with a resource on it, in the same way the Chinese have claimed the entire South China Sea. And we're into the best columns of the week. First up, voter ID laws have no impact. Voter ID, early voting, and mail-in ballots have little or no impact on which party wins elections, said Bill Scheer. That's the takeaway from the 2022 midterms. Everything both parties have told themselves about election laws was proved wrong. In Georgia, Republicans passed a law in 2021 that limited access to ballot drop boxes, increased ID requirements for mail-in voting, and banned mobile voting buses. Democrats called the law Jim Crow 2.0 and said the clear intent was to deter black voters. But such laws invariably boomerang and galvanize voters. In the Georgia Senate runoff, large black turnout propelled Democrat Raphael Warnock to victory. Democrats also claimed victories in the Arizona Senate race and gubernatorial races in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Kansas, all states that have adopted voter ID laws. In New York State, where Democrats passed laws to make voting more accessible, Republicans gained 4 House seats, helping them take control of the House. Republicans have begun to realize that easier access to voting doesn't only help young people of color, but also white seniors more likely to vote Republican. It's now clear that increased voting access does not naturally advantage either party. The truth about cops and crime. It's an item of faith among conservatives that crime has risen in recent years because progressive cities defunded the police, said Radley Balco. But only a handful of cities cut police budgets after the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. In fact, most cities increased funding for cops. Cities such as Mobile, Indianapolis, Albuquerque, and Columbus set homicide records in the past 2 years, even while adding uniformed police officers. Recent research has repeatedly found that more spending on police doesn't even correlate with, much less cause, less crime. In many cities, people feel less safe because of the widely publicized but false narrative that police resources have been cut, allowing criminals to run wild. But statistics from all over the country show that more or fewer cops makes little difference to historical trends of rising and falling crime. Hiring more cops comes with costs, including more bad interactions with civilians and more distrust of cops in minority communities. Can we stop pretending that cities inevitably sink into chaos with fewer cops and would always be better and safer with more? This comes from Germany. The far-right movement to restore the Kaiser. Germany just avoided its own January 6th, said Tony Barber in the Financial Times. Police arrested 25 extremists last week for allegedly planning to storm the parliament and overthrow the German government in the largest radical right-wing conspiracy in the country's post-war history. It was a mass operation with some 3,000 police fanning out across 11 of Germany's 16 states to raid homes and offices. Most of the coup plotters were bunglers, weirdos, and nostalgists, not skilled professional revolutionaries. But Germany has reason for real concern. Some of those arrested were ex-military. One was a judge and former legislator from the far-right Alternative for Germany party. The whole crew was swimming in the same turbid seas of malicious and anti-democratic fantasies and seditious scheming that drove the QAnon-inspired insurrectionists in the United States. Right-wing extremism has presented a known threat to modern Germany since at least February 2020, when a migrant-hating gunman killed 9 people at a hookah bar in the multicultural city of Hanau. But for many years, the problem was obscured by acts of Islamist terrorism. As the foiled plots shows, no democracy can afford complacency. They sound like cranks, said Michael Gottschenberg in Tagesschau. But this is serious. The coup plotters are part of the Reichsbürger, or Empire Citizens, movement, which holds that every German government since World War I has been illegitimate. The 20,000 members want to create a new German empire and restore the Kaiser, specifically Prince Heinrich XIII, a 71-year-old royal who's actually 17th in line for the throne, not first. This group is heavily armed and extremely dangerous. Twice in recent years, its members have shot at police, killing an officer in 2016. And in 2020, at a rally against COVID restrictions, they actually stormed up the stairs of the Reichstag building in an attempt to enter the parliament. Yet the Reichsbürger don't have what it takes to overthrow the government, said Hakan Bostrom in Gottesberg Posten. A successful coup needs the backing of strong vested interests, such as the armed forces. While Germany's military has occasionally ferreted out neo-Nazis, it is not dominated by right-wing extremists or anti-democrats who would join a coup. Nor is Prince Heinrich some James Bond villain itching to seize power, but rather, as his family describes him, a confused old man. The Reichsbürger are simply violent lunatics, dangerous, yet, but hardly a threat to democracy. The newly worrying element, said La Vanguardia from Spain in an editorial, is the marriage of extreme right politics with the conspiracy true believers. The far right is gaining across Europe. It's the third largest political force in both France and Spain, and actually rules Italy. At the same time, American-style QAnon nuttery has metastasized here as well, with European language variants all over YouTube. These two groups shared the belief that the democratic and liberal order should be overthrown and replaced by another of a populist and illiberal direction. Their convergence poses a real danger to Germany and to all of us. The last word, our feature article, titled this week, It's Okay to Let Go. When my father died, said Rosalie Metro in the Washington Post magazine, I felt a terrible grief and also a troubling sense of relief. In my dreams, my dad is alive. He appears beside me in the grocery store, clutching a list of items he wants me to purchase for him. There are always things that suit his esoteric taste but are difficult to find in Missouri, like teff flour or broccoli rabe. Or he calls me with complaints about the loud neighbors at his independent living facility. But when I try to dial the manager to sort things out, the numbers on my phone start melting. My dad died this past March when my sister and I made the decision to withdraw life support after an unsuccessful cardiac procedure. I scattered his ashes beside the Pacific Ocean this spring. In some Buddhist traditions, Bardo, the liminal state between one incarnation and the next, is said to last up to 49 days. But it's been 6 months, and my dreams still involve explaining to my dad that he's dead. He's incredulous. Once my sister was in the dream, too, and I called on her for backup. "Zo, Dad's dead, right?" He always did accept truths from her that he wouldn't from me. Waking up from these dreams, I feel something familiar. Relief. It's like swimming upward to a place where I can breathe again. I think Dad keeps returning to me in dreams because I feel guilty that my life is easier now that he's gone. The dreaded freedom, that's what my friend Katie Terry called it when I told her my dad had died. Most friends had guessed, even if I hadn't told them, that my dad had challenges. He had suffered from mental illness for most of his life and had moved to be closer to me 5 years prior as his overall health deteriorated. I was grateful for Katie's phrase because it was my first indication that it was okay to feel anything other than sadness about his death. Katie had cared for her mother through a brutal decline into dementia, so she knew that death can mean many things, not all of them bad. Grief and relief. Is it wrong to feel relieved when someone dies? It's the title of an online video by psychotherapist Joe Waltz that caught my attention during a late-night Googling session. While speaking to Waltz for this piece, I learned research indicates that relief is an extremely common reaction caregivers have to the death of a loved one who had dementia. But he noted that similar feelings may appear in those whose parents experienced other struggles particular to aging. It's very natural to think, hey, I don't have to change my parents' diaper anymore. I don't have to do all these painful, time-consuming, tiring things, Waltz told me. Why hadn't I heard this before? All I knew about grief was what had filtered into the popular imagination based on the work of psychologist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, that it has five stages: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Litza Williams, a clinical social worker, told me that the first thing I need to know about the stages of grief is that they're not real. Kubler-Ross observed the stages in people diagnosed with terminal illness in relation to their own deaths, not in those dealing with other deaths. I think people like the stages, Williams said, because it takes something incredibly complex and overwhelming and difficult and makes it neat and tidy, like, oh, it's just going to be these five little stages, and it ends up in acceptance. The popular understanding of these stages, she said, may lead people to feel they are grieving wrong. I'm sorry is the most common response when people hear that a parent has died, and some variation on thank you, it's really sad, is a frequent reply. But sad does not begin to cover the complexity of what many adult children feel when their parents die. I was sorry my dad died, and I was not sorry, yet I had few models for these feelings. By the time I came along, my father had already had a difficult life. He grew up in a working-class family in Bridgeport, Connecticut. He was an intellectual and a poet in a neighborhood where men were judged on how well they could throw a punch. He struggled to be accepted by his alcoholic father. As a teenager, my dad fell into a depression that would chase him his whole life. The healthcare system being what it was in the 1950s, he was misdiagnosed with schizophrenia and sent to a mental institution where he received electroconvulsive therapy that erased much of his memory of his childhood. Whether it was a result of this trauma or related to his late in life diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, my dad oscillated during my lifetime between what the Institute for Challenging Disorganization would classify as level 1 and level 3 hoarding. In my childhood home, I wended my way between piles of newspapers that narrowed the hallways. There was a room full of empty bottles that we called the Plain of Jars. Over 20 years, he carefully saved a garbage bag full of plastic forks and spoons for a picnic with thousands of his friends, we joked. We couldn't save his marriage to my mom, but he could save the Sonny Rollins record she bought him for his birthday in 1983, still wrapped for 30 years. He couldn't prevent me and my sister from leaving home, but he could save the plastic barrettes that had fallen from our hair into the green shag carpet. In a jar with marbles, rusty paper clips, and orphaned keys. My dad was brilliant, funny, gentle person. His heroes were Malcolm X and Charles Darwin, and he read everything from poet Sharon Olds to the Federalist Papers, which was the book he brought to the hospital with him the day he died. When I was a teenager, we'd take the train into New York together. We saw Edward Hopper at the Whitney Museum, and Shakespeare in the Park. His expectations for me were high. For my 14th birthday, he gave me German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche's Thus Spake Zarathustra. I would need to know, he said, how to confront what he called the ultimate question, how to relate to death. He told me we were different from other people, honest beyond social conventions, but I wondered later whether I needed to know as a teenager that his antidepressants lowered his libido. Was it okay for him to ask me as a college student to open credit card account that he could transfer his debts to? Was it normal that I spent summers in my 20s secretly taking loads of garbage from his house to the dumpster behind CVS? As I entered adulthood, I kept in close touch with Dad. I wrote him postcards from Chiang Mai and Berlin, and I felt his pride that I'd done the things he'd always wanted to do. Travel, get a PhD, build a stable family. He sent me multiple one-line emails every day, each with a foreboding subject line. Capitalism. My mortality. Licorice panna cotta. But once my husband, Sean, and I had settled down in a Midwestern college town and had kids, my worries about Dad increased. He'd had a heart attack in his 50s and triple bypass surgery in his 60s, and his mother and brother had both had dementia. By then, in his mid-70s, he complained of loneliness every time I spoke with him. After years of resisting my pleas, Dad left Connecticut, his lifelong home, in the summer of 2017. We found him an apartment around the corner from us and helped him move in his boxfuls of newspapers dating back to the 80s, and his collection of sample-sized tubes of toothpaste in various stages of use. Thus began the hardest years of my life. Until then, Dad had been unfailingly gentle with me, albeit persistently melancholy. The person who arrived in Missouri was desperately unhappy, fragile, and belligerent. He'd sometimes knock on the door at 10 p.m., saying he felt anxious, and insist on sleeping over. He always wanted to move in with us, but I didn't think my solid but strained by circumstances marriage could withstand Dad's constant presence. My sister did the best she could to help from afar, but I was overwhelmed. The only time Dad was happy and relaxed was when he was with his grandkids. He found library books to read to them that matched their interest, spelling out difficult words just as he'd done for me and my sister. He let my son beat him at soccer, 1,000,000-6. I got to glimpse the parent he'd been to me further back than I could remember, and my heart broke with tenderness. Then his health problems escalated, And in the summer of 2020, he had a stroke that affected his mobility and made driving dangerous. I followed his doctor's advice to secure him a place in an independent living facility, which he despised. When I woke up in the night, my thoughts inevitably turned to him. When was the last time he had taken a shower? How could I persuade him to agree to a cognitive evaluation? How long was all this going to last? Was it wrong to even think about that? Die at the right time, Nietzsche wrote in the book Dad had given me when I was a teenager. But Dad never wanted to die. He feared death more than anyone I knew. The loss of control reminded him of electroshock therapy. He was a hypochondriac who also happened to have a lot of health problems, and so his death had been a frequent topic of conversation. "You brought me to Missouri to die," he'd tell me accusingly, as if he'd been immortal had he stayed in Connecticut. But in a way, he was right. I hadn't wanted him to die alone, thousands of miles from me, food rotting in his fridge, and my plan worked. When the hospital called one Wednesday afternoon in March, I was only 10 minutes away. Lo, that was how the cardiologist answered my question about Dad's chances of survival. He'd gone into the hospital that morning for a planned cardiac ablation, but his blood pressure had dropped during the procedure. At 81, his body turned out to be too fragile for such an intervention. His brain had been deprived of oxygen for too long to be able to return to its previous functionality. "You can ask yourself what your father would have wanted," the doctor said. "Would he be ready to let go?" Despite the gravity of the moment, I almost laughed. I thought of the newspapers, the toothpaste tubes, the plastic forks. No, he was not ready to let go. But was I? I called my sister, Zoe. As a nurse, she had seen these situations before, and she was clear. Just make him comfortable and let him go. The doctors were happy to, as they put it, change the goals of care. I stood at Dad's bedside while they removed his ventilation tube and administered morphine. I noticed the soft fuzz of hair on his scalp. He'd asked me to take him for a haircut, and I hadn't had the chance. I started to cry. "Dad, we love you. It's okay to let go," I whispered. "I'm right here with you." It took longer than I thought it would. I worried that he was going to wake up and be mad at me for killing him. Then his heart beat one more time and stopped. In the last years of my dad's life, I felt like he was wearing a disturbing Halloween costume that he couldn't take off. He was trapped, and I was trapped with him. His death was the only way out of the excruciating dynamics that had warped our relationship, the only way I could connect with the parent he was to me when he was still able. After my dad died, Zoe, Sean, and I waded into the apartment full of his hoarded possessions. We recycled thousands of recipes he had carefully clipped from the New York Times. We donated a closet full of new apparel with tags still on, which he'd been saving for some unknown future in which he felt worthy of them. And we threw away the small collection of raggedy clothes he'd actually worn. I saved whatever I could, but it wasn't much. When I turned the key for the last time on that empty apartment, I thought I was finished. Now I know it will take much longer to sort through everything my dad left behind. But I'm moving forward, slowly. While I was writing this article, I had a new dream about my dad. He was his old self, sweet and gentle. When I woke up, I missed him. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post magazine. pick up one of the Health and Science articles this week, looking into the distant past. Scientists have begun building the world's largest radio telescope, reports The Guardian. One so sensitive it will be able to see the universe right after the Big Bang. Some 30 years in the planning, the Square Kilometer Array, SKA, is actually two big telescope arrays spread in regions selected for their remoteness. In Western Australia, SKA Low will consist of 131,000 Christmas tree-like antennas, so sensitive to low-frequency signals, while the Karoo Desert region of South Africa, SKA Mid, will use an array of 197 satellite dishes to capture the mid-range signals. With its unrivaled sensitivity and resolution, the SKA will be able to examine the faintest radio signals from sources billions of light years from Earth, including those emitted in the first few hundred million years after the Big Bang. Scientists hope it will help them learn about all kinds of phenomena, from dark matter to the origin of the mysterious pulses of radio emissions known as fast radio bursts. The observatory will define the next 50 years for radio astronomy, charting the birth and death of galaxies, searching for new types of gravitational waves, and expanding the boundaries of what we know about the universe, said Sarah Pierce, director of SKA Low. The SKA telescopes will be sensitive enough to detect an airport radar on a planet circling a star tens of light years away. So may even answer the biggest question of all. Are we alone in the universe? And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page, starting with an article titled, Culture Wars, the Backlash Against Drag. Drag shows have become an increasingly tense and armed front line in the nation's fraught struggle over gender and identity, said J. David Goodman and Ruth Graham in the New York Times. In recent months, a growing number of those shows have been targeted for threats and disruptions by right-wing groups, in particular those open to children, such as a drag queen's story hours at libraries. Such events have drawn ire from conservative commentators and politicians who say they're grooming and sexualizing children. Dozens of shows have been targeted. In Memphis, armed protesters shut down a drag event at a museum. In Columbus, Ohio, a church story hour was canceled after a mob of Proud Boys showed up. Last month, a gunman charged into a Colorado Springs gay nightclub during a drag show, killing five and injuring 25. Several states, including Tennessee and Texas, are now considering bills to rein in drag shows, including prohibitions on minors from attending. Drag has gotten way out of hand, said Christopher Rufo in City Journal. The LGBTQ activists who promote drag story hours for kids cast them as harmless fun that promotes reading, tolerance, and inclusion. Drag queens may claim to be engaging in harmless, campy fun, but some engage in suggestive behavior, and they all convey an utterly serious message about the deconstruction of sex and subversion of middle-class family life. It's no wonder many parents want to draw a bright line between adult sexuality and childhood innocence. What hateful nonsense, said Danielle Drellinger in USA Today. For decades, male performers dressed as women have entertained audiences on TV, movies, and in theater. There is nothing inherently sexual about a man in women's clothing reading to children. It's no surprise the rights freakout comes a moment when LGBTQ rights, visibility, prevalence, and acceptance have blossomed. For conservatives rattled by changing mores, drag poses an existential threat, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. It underlines the extent to which gender is socially constructed and performative. That is deeply threatening to insecure males who pine for some imaginary glory days when the line between the genders was thick and inflexible, and straight men dominated. Playing with self-presentation seems like harmless fun to many of us. For the paranoid fascist right, however, it's deadly serious business. Trump, has the GOP had enough? For 6 years, Donald Trump has served as the GOP's strongman ruler, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. But the loss of Trump's hand-picked candidate, Herschel Walker, in the Georgia Senate race has completed a disastrous midterm for MAGA Republicans. With sharp criticism of a wounded Trump growing, other right-wing populists are jockeying for position in a potential post-Trump world. The increasingly irrelevant Trump is holed up in his Florida mansion, facing multiple criminal investigations and the tax fraud conviction of his real estate company. He further wounded himself by dining with anti-Semites and calling for the termination of the Constitution so he could be reinstalled as president. In the midterms, Trump's endorsed Senate, governor, and Secretary of State candidates went a humiliating 2-for-14, said Charlie Sykes in the Bulwark. The man who once boasted that his supporters would grow tired of winning is now a chronic loser. But the big question facing the GOP now is, will the cult-like MAGA base really give up on Trump? They'd better if they don't want to see more Democratic victory, said John McCormick in National Review. The GOP lost many winnable elections because Trump endorsed kooky candidates like Walker and the weirdo Blake Masters, who lost his Senate race in Arizona by 5 points. Most Republicans want to vote for normal conservatives, like Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, and some will refuse to cast ballots for unqualified nut jobs. This may sound crazy, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic, but Trump is so unpopular, especially among independents, that Democrats should root for him to be the GOP's 2024 presidential nominee. He's become the most beatable Republican out there, by far. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis may be a Trumpist in substance, but if he's nominated, the narrative will be that the GOP is normal again. Republicans can be normal again if they dump Trump, said John Podhoretz in commentary. Although there is a red-hot center of Republican voters who worship the MAGA king, there is a larger, more traditional GOP base that threw in their lot with him. These voters can be wooed back to sanity if the party nominates candidates with traditional conservative views. A secure border, small government, low taxes, and a strong military and police. Returning to those values is the key to the Republican Party's salvation. And some shorter notes. An estimated 196 Americans are dying daily from fentanyl overdoses, which nearly doubled from 2019 to 2021. Last year, there were 107,622 overdoses in the U.S., two-thirds of them from fentanyl, according to a provisional CDC count. Fentanyl is now the leading cause of death for Americans between 18 and 49. The average cost of a gallon of gas in the U.S. has dropped from a peak of more than $5 a gallon in June to $3.21, lower than before the invasion of Ukraine roiled world oil markets. High prices through much of the year led to a doubling of profits for oil producers to an unprecedented $4 trillion. Of the nearly 1,000 recipients of the Nobel Prize in its 121-year history, the vast majority in all categories have been men from Western countries. Only 60 prizes have been awarded to women and 17 to black people of any nation. About 250,000 Cubans, or more than 2% of the country's population, have migrated to the U.S. over the past year alone. Government data shows the pandemic's evisceration of the tourism industry and the tightening of U.S. sanctions have deepened the socialist nation's poverty and kicked off the largest exodus from Cuba since the 1959 revolution. On the poll watch, 56% of Republican voters want Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to run for president in 2024, while 33% prefer former President Donald Trump. In a matchup between the current and former presidents, 47% of voters would back Joe Biden, while 40% would vote for Trump. Meanwhile, Biden trails DeSantis in a head-to-head race, 43% to 47%. 31% think social media platforms like Twitter aren't strict enough in regulating content. 27% think they're about right. 21% think that they're too strict. And we'll get two quotes today. First, from Sam Rayburn, quoted in the Bharat Express News, says, "Any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a good carpenter to build one." And John Le Carré, quoted in The Baffler, says, "The winners forget, but the victims have terribly long memories." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.